The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Robert Crayford is a portfolio manager at CQS Natural Resources, one of the most influential natural resources funds in London. It's been around for a while, but always good to catch up with you, Robert. Good to see you.
Great. Yeah, thank you for having us.
So how's it going at CQS? Perhaps you could give us a kind of broad outline of the strategy and the aims of CQS, and then we can get into a little bit more of the detail of where you see CQS sitting now in the current resources environment.
As a quick one, Keith and I co-manage on three resources-focused investment trusts. So we've got CQS Natural Resources, which we're touching on today, but we've also got Geiger Counter, which is a uranium-focused fund, and Golden Prospect, which is a precious metal mining-focused fund. So, there's quite a lot of overlap into CQS Natural Resources, which has quite a kind of broad mandate. And we feel pretty fortunate, actually, in that given that it has a pretty openly, actively managed mandate, that really allows us flexibility to kind of reallocate across commodities, depending where we see the cycle. So, it's very much a key differentiator versus, kind of ETFs or, kind of broader funds, which end up kind of weighting more towards liquidity. As a result, we think we can kind of generate incremental performance, and that's certainly been evident in recent history. So as a result of that kind of major allocation across commodities.
So what are some of the major holdings in CQS that you can talk about then?
If we touch what is publicly available, we have a monthly fact sheet, but you can see got a very heavy weighting towards precious metals, and you see top of the list there would be the likes of Equinox, which is a big Canadian or kind of North American producer with a couple of big assets in Canada, but also in Nicaragua and some in the US as well. So and one in Mexico that could potentially come online. So we've kind of got names like that, but our largest position actually currently is NexGen, which is a large uranium asset, which is just kind of going through final permitting stages. So we anticipate that to come through in February next year, kind of view that as a catalyst. But we think the uranium sector is super interesting as well. But at the moment, the major positioning we have is definitely towards precious metals.
And that's not done badly for you over the past 6 to 12 months, has it really, Robert? What's the CQS view about how that's gone in gold and silver and the rest?
We kind of really heavily allocated in towards precious metals around 18 months ago. So certainly fortuitous timing, but many of the reasons we saw for doing that, we still see as being pretty evident today. At the time, we were kind of seeing very strong demand led by central banks. That's kind of continuing. That kind of came post the Russian invasion of Ukraine and sort of weaponization of the US dollar. That story's kind of evolved. And ultimately, within our allocation, we kind of look at a top-down and bottom-up view. So if we really like the commodity and the stocks are cheap, then ultimately we end up to a large weighting. And that kind of leaves us where we are today. So yes, it's done very well, but actually, we look across many of the names we own, and there are some of the most attractive valuations that we can see on any kind of historical data that we have, given that the run-up in the commodity has been so strong.
I mean, the central bank buying that you mentioned there has really been key to this whole precious metals run, hasn't it? The idea that some central banks no longer think the international financial system is completely safe for them to be in, or at least they want some sort of backup plan as well. So that's why they're buying so much gold. Do you see that the way I've just laid it out, or do you see a slightly different angle to it?
Yeah, look, I mean, I could really go down a rabbit warren here, but one of the things that we see, I mean, firstly, it was the weaponization of the US dollar. So when Russia wasn't able to access the treasuries it held, it clearly showed that it isn't a reserve or as stable a reserve for nations that are concerned around threats from the US and certainly the West. Obviously China then ends up being a strong buyer, unsurprisingly, among some other nations. I feel like that's kind of really evolved as well to a bigger kind of fiat currency concern. In this world where we've got, ever increasing government debt, which has long been flagged, it's certainly our view that this is a much bigger issue here and now, because increasing government debt levels globally is okay when you're in a kind of 1% rate environment. But when we're in a higher rate environment now, and you end up having kind of inflation proving to be sticky, and we're kind of seeing that. There were certainly expectations that the COVID inflation would end up coming back more materially, and it's showing to not. And as a result, that kind of pushes up rates. And it's that higher debt level and higher rates combined that end up increasing the interest burden on governments globally. And that ends up, self-fulfilling an issue where they end up having to raise more because, to balance budgets. And ultimately, it leads to a world where they have to issue more debt, there's less buyers, and ultimately that pushes rates higher, and there's a bit of a feedback loop. So against that, you end up kind of printing more money, and then you end up getting inflation through currency devaluation, which is, people have been referring to it as the debasement trade. But we think it's, it may be getting a bit less headlines than it has, a few months ago, but we think it's very much still evident and very much a trend over the next decade. And we don't really see any way out of government debt levels without having a bout of heavy inflation. I draw comps to the 70s, and I'm not going to kind of go as fear mongering as that, but certainly some higher inflation levels is arguably the only way that governments can really address these debt levels, because it's arguably it's simply unsustainable at this point.
I mean, it's interesting that when gold pulled back, it sort of settled and consolidated at around the $4,000 level, which is quite an amazing statement to be making if you sort of project backwards in time, 12 months or a couple of years. But it really seems that this is a new normal in a way. I don't know if you agree with that statement, but that's the way it looks to me.
Well, we often get asked, where's gold going to go? And it's very difficult to say where it's going to be in a year's time. There are so many factors driving in. If there's one commodity that has more inputs than any other, then arguably gold is that. But we kind of addressed it more from a flow perspective. So if you look at the reasons that gold has been strong, central bank buying being one, yes, you had the weaponization of US dollar, but now you've got kind of US trade tensions and pressures on well, especially on China. So we're seeing tensions there, but also globally. So governments are kind of leaning more into having reserve currencies that aren't under the influence or control of other nation states. So clearly that incentive remains. So we think that remains. I think the big key factor, well, also sorry, barring coin has been strong. So that's kind of led by of high net worth primarily, and kind of international retail. So we see quite strong demand, particularly in Asia, for bar and coin demand. Jewelry, unsurprisingly, softer. But the real kind of swing factor here is going to be more around financial market players, where it's been quite interesting to see that post-COVID, 2020 till start of this year, we've pretty much seen steady selling of the physical ETFs, physical gold ETFs, and only buying returning through 2025. And it's our view that actually generalists more broadly, certainly on the fund management side on the asset side, remain pretty heavily underweight. So that's across both the physical and miners. And then there's always a debate there about what is a fair weight. But I think we've gone through such a long period where people have had incredibly low weights. That having 1% feels like a large position, or maybe getting up to 2% for some of the wealth managers, where in reality, if you go back in history, it's been as high as 10, 12% within assets. But it's our argument, if you're in a real concern around fiat currency debasement and purchasing power of underlying currencies, that there is potentially more support to come through from an underweight purchasing and via the ETFs. And via equities and the companies. So that's certainly our belief. So from a flow perspective, it's been strong, but there's reasons to think that it can continue And what we're seeing now is on pullbacks, we're seeing quite strong buying as those that are underweight, primarily in the likes of, say, Canada and Australia, where precious metal miners meet a more meaningful part of their benchmark. And they've been heavily underweight through this rally, which happened very quickly, that they end up being dip buyers, which is one of the reasons why we don't think we've seen as meaningful a correction as some had anticipated, given the fairly parabolic rise that we're starting to see in gold coming into kind of October.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. So, as far as CQS is concerned, then, are you mainly invested in gold equities, or do you have any other instruments in there as well?
Yeah, it's a long only equity fund, so yeah, it's pretty much entirely through through mining equities, and we're also very happy to be doing so because the valuations on these, I mean, as I was saying earlier, given the strong run up we've had in gold price, we can easily find multi-billion dollar type producers at trading around sort of 0.5 NAV, 0.6 NAV, strong free cash flow. Very solid balance sheets and growth projects in the pipeline that aren't even get any credit within those assumptions that we think offer incremental upside over and above. So yeah, it's a comfortable place to be where I'd say we have more conviction around the bottom up valuation than we do the top down. But that's not to say that we don't see upside in the gold price. It's just we can say very factually that the underlying equities aren't rich here.
I mean, it's been amazing to see some of the share price performances, even from some of the world's largest gold mining companies over the last 6 to 12 months. In a way, it's obvious that they would go up in conjunction with the gold price, but the amount of sort of market capitalization that's being added as a result of that is very, very chunky, isn't it? So presumably you guys are enjoying some of those gains inside your own portfolio.
Yeah, like I mean, it's yeah, we've had a very good year for the fund. It's been one of the top performing resources funds, certainly in London, if not globally. And a big chunk of that is down to having a very large precious metal weighting, certainly higher than many of our peers, and certainly higher than the sort of broader mining ETFs. So yeah, that has clearly been favourable. I mean, you talk there to the performance in the equities. I would flag there is actually many of the miners had really lagged the gold price. And when I say lagged, actually, as gold price was increasing kind of through 24 and early 25, it was moving in a more one-to-one relationship with gold. So, if gold went up 1%, the miners would go up 1%. And this wasn't accounting for the operating leverage that you inherently see within the operating models of the miners. So, to put simply, if gold's at 2,000 and it goes to 3,000, it's gone up 50%. But if you're a gold miner producing at 1,000, you've got your margin's gone from 1,000 to 2,000, and that was, so you basically get what's called operating leverage. You should get a higher increase in the effective gold price move, but not entirely unfairly because they're in the penalty box post-COVID, where we saw the rise in gold price, but ultimately they saw cost inflation much like the rest of us have all felt. And that ended up meaning, yes, revenues have gone up, but cost ended up increasing, and that started to squeeze margins back to something comparable to prior. And that was one of the reasons we saw the real lag across the gold miners. What we're seeing now is quite a different dynamic, where actually a lot more of that is translating through. I do think from here we'll probably start to see a bit more cost inflation feeding through to a number of the miners. So there's been a lot of capital raises within the sector, so that starts to put a bit more pressure on some service costs, for example. But the big impacts, the big things that really fed through post-COVID, which was energy costs and labour costs, we're just not seeing the same cost pressures. So we think these margins are more sustainable. Clearly, there's going to be an incentive for a number of the miners to kind of shift down to some lower grade components or parts of their mines if they want to increase production. Arguably, that is good for the equities, but it could lead to what for those specific equities because it's an economic decision. But it could feed through to a view of higher costs. And just in the last couple of weeks, we've met quite a few of the big miners, and there's very much a clear message from the industry is they're still very heavily focused on trying to keep costs low. trying to stop cost pressure. Or they kind of learn the lessons of the last 5 years where they got penalized, and there's a big heavy focus there of not letting costs kind of blow out just because margins have got higher. So we're hoping that holds. There's been a lot of caution around kind of M&A, but I think we've started to see that pick up because the sector overall has very strong balance sheets, many with zero debt, growing cash piles, and still dividends kind of remain fairly minimal as they're kind of paying those out on a plan around sort of 2,500, 2,800 gold rather than where we are at spot.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you think the companies are going to do with all the cash that's coming in, because obviously it's significantly larger cash flows into the gold mining industry than there have been for I don't know, forever, I suppose, in looking at it in a non-inflation adjusted way. And you also mentioned the mistakes of the past, so there is this conundrum, isn't there, that there's a lot of cash. Does it go straight back to shareholders? Does it go on M&A? Does it go on incremental expansion? I mean, what's your feeling about where the gold industry is going to allocate the increasing inflow of dollars that are coming into it?
Yeah, so I mean, as I was saying earlier, so we've had some minimal kind of M&A so far. We've had a bit going on, but a lot of it seems to be, of the companies we're speaking to, focused on kind of operational improvements they're seeing at their own assets. That's kind of where they see the highest IRR or return on capital. And so they're trying to do that to expand where they can. But ultimately, the cash returns for the industry are so strong. I think we're going to start to see quite a heavy bout of share buybacks. And I say that because American investors generally materially prefer buybacks over dividends due to tax implications around capital gains, etc. We're a bit more sort of nuanced around it because buybacks are often done at the top, bottom, just through the nature of it. So I can see kind of arguments on both sides. And I know some UK investors or some European investors often lean a bit more into dividends. But yeah, we think buybacks will probably be the focus, given that's the source of where most of the investment capital is coming from. So I think we'll start to see a real shift in that, particularly because valuations aren't too stretched. It's I really struggle to find many names that are trading a notable premium to NAV. It's only really probably arguably Agnico, but even that's kind of questionable depending how you kind of view their execution, as they are one of the, they are the largest and arguably one of the best operators in the industry. But then you drop down into kind of the mid tiers, and most names are trading at sub NAV, where actually buybacks make a lot more sense. So I think that will end up being the first focus. But we're starting to see a bit more M&A pick up. So this is often led by investors, specialists, resource specialists such as ourselves, that start to speak to companies and go, "Well, this is great. You're making loads of money, but what are you going to do with it? Where's your next growth projects?" After years of being told, just focus on returns, and the reality is they haven't invested in their own organic pipelines. Often larger miners are actually pretty ineffective at exploration. They just can't run it as efficiently as smaller companies. And we see the likes of Agnico taking their 9.9 stakes in many smaller miners. And what we see in the industry overall is really trying to replicate that model, which we kind of call the Agnico model, and it's pretty kind of widespread now, where these mid tiers and larger caps end up taking, the 9.9 or 19.9 type stakes in some of these junior names. And yeah, ultimately we think there is an M&A cycle coming up, and they will start to look to add in some of these development projects to backfill their pipeline. What we've seen recently is, they've, or certainly over the last few years, is they've been pretty cautious around committing to capital, big capital bill spends. So, building new mines, because you get CapEx overruns and management teams get penalized. But I think what we've seen is an easing in those pressures, more projects coming on kind of on time, on budget, or not massive blowouts, certainly on the gold side. And yeah, I think that's kind of increasing the incentive there to kind of backfill that pipeline by development assets. And that's certainly one of the ways that we're positioned across, well, certainly across Seacrest Natural Resources and Golden Prospect.
Yeah, so if I understand what you're saying correctly, you reckon there'll be some sort of a trickle-down effect, at least into the more junior ends of the mining sector. The junior explorers will begin to benefit from some of the cash that's coming in at the top end as the bigger companies look to replenish their assets.
Yes, definitely. But I'd caveat that. That waterfall point is exactly right, but the many of the producers are still pretty attractively valued. That you get the real waterfall when they start to look rich, and then people are then really kind of chased down. That said, the difference in valuation is often pretty extreme. For example, I was talking earlier around some of those, multi-billion type kind of mid-tier gold producers trading around 0.6 times price to NAV. But then you can get these large scale developers, which are kind of either near permitting or pretty low risk, ultimately come online in the next 2 or 3 years, and you can find those trading around 0.1 price to NAV. So there's a real incentive there for them to buy them and ultimately put them into the pipeline. So yes, there is an incentive, and I think the trigger there is going to be probably more the cash on the balance sheets of the corporates as they look to backfill their pipeline, necessarily than investors. So I think a lot of generalist investors coming in, and that's always going to be the trigger here. It's going to be new money coming in that drives the shift in valuation. And I think they're going to, at the moment, they can still find very attractive names around those mid tiers. So we obviously know the largest names often get the first money. Royalties are obviously a good safe bet for a generalist because they don't have to take asset specific risk. But as a result, those valuations are looking richer relative, and then it starts to roll through to your waterfall analogy.
Right. So you mentioned a little while ago in our conversation, Robert, Australia and Canada as major sort of mining centres, and CQS obviously invests around the world. Is it your impression currently that the mining sector in general is firing on all cylinders in Australia and Canada, and a little less efficiently here in London?
Very commodity by commodity. I mean, certainly the precious metal sector has kind of woken up and is pretty alive. We look across some of the base metals, and it's not quite as excited, depending which one you pick. Copper is obviously quite well supported. That's had a lot of sort of generalist backing and view around kind of electrification and broader trends there. But yes, it's very, very commodity by commodity, and we have sub cycles within a broader commodity cycle. They don't all move in unison.
So the name CQS Natural Resources, quite a broad spectrum encompassed in the name. Is there are there any commodities that you avoid?
Currently we have zero weight in iron ore, for example. We're kind of cautious around iron ore, just down. I mean, the split case to it, but just down to the fact that you are effectively run by an oligopoly of three or four major producers. So Ryobi, HP, Vale, and then FMG as being the fourth. And ultimately, you have one big demand center in China, and as being kind of one of the major drivers, as well as global. But we've seen a massive downturn, obviously, in Chinese property, which I think we're about 5 or 6 years into now, or certainly four or so years. And we don't see a sharp rebound there in Chinese building and construction, and that's simply down to demographics. They've hit peak population, one child policy is feeding through, and they're going to see declining populations unless they start to see allow a lot more immigration. Go a bit more kind of Japanese model. So yeah, we don't see a V shape in iron ore demand on that basis, because ultimately they have enough property, there is an excess of spare capacity, and they have a declining population. So that was one of our key reasons. Arguably that has all played out now. So we're not it's not like we're seeing any declines in iron ore demand, because that has kind of happened. We're just not seeing the construction feed through now as we've gone through that. Gone through the snake of those projects effectively kind of feeding through. So then the real question mark then becomes about kind of build more globally. And there's certainly some numbers and estimates put around this kind of data center build, et cetera. But I think relative to Chinese property, it's kind of hard to put even the huge scale of investment in those into the same scale of what we were seeing across Chinese property construction. So that's one of the reasons for concern. We've also got some big new mines coming on with the likes of Simandou from Guinea, which will be ramping up over the next few years, which is higher grade, will displace some of the Australian material. And that's one of the reasons for cautious there. But yeah, I mean, I can carry on. There are many commodities to kind of cover.
Well, I mean, I was going to just follow up with a question about copper because, in your analysis of the Chinese property market, there is there a read across with copper as well? Because obviously, that's a big component in Chinese construction.
Yes, there is. But again, similar like I was saying with iron ore, I think we've largely seen that in the numbers now. So it's not like there's going to be negative revisions in demand because of it, because that has already occurred. So what we're seeing now is almost a clean number without that. But I don't see a sharp rebound in construction to be a driver. I mean, look, we love the sort of medium long term thematics in copper. Clearly, broader electrification is very much true. There are many large projects out there with sort of declining grades. We need new projects to come online simply to offset them. The dynamics are clearly there. I think one of the concerns we had is many generous investors had kind of poured into this Goldman's rhetoric around copper is the new oil and it's going to 20,000 or whatever price. I can't remember what price they'd set now, but ultimately sky high in the near term. And the reality is the market isn't in deficit today. Actually, I think it's probably in a small surplus if you look across estimates. So there's a view there of, until we really see those deficits coming to fruition, it's are we going to see copper price spike materially higher? I think it's our well, it's certainly our view that we're positioning more for a tighter copper market in around 3 years. 3 to 4 years. We are seeing quite strong buying from the Chinese, in part, I think, due to this, similar reducing down their treasury holding and adding to gold. We also think they're adding to kind of strategic commodities, and copper would certainly be one. And also, we're putting it in a warehouse because they'd rather own more of it. But so how have we positioned? I think the view around the miners themselves had been so positive that we've seen a lot of generous money flow in, and copper miners ended up trading to quite a premium relative to other names we were looking at, often to a premium to NAV, where we could own the developers or some earlier stage projects that don't come on for 3, 4 years, a huge discount relative to them, because no generous money would ever touch a pre-production. Well, sorry, not no, that's a bit extreme, but a lot of generous money wouldn't go into pre-production given the inherent risks with it. And we felt that that was a better positioning play into the timing of that cycle and how we view it, because you can effectively buy them at 0.1 or 0.15 NAV. If copper ends up being strong or it comes strong sooner, then actually you just bid them up sooner because you suddenly create more of an M&A cycle, and we preferred that as the way to play it.
So, are there any copper companies in the CQS portfolio that you'd highlight?
I mean, if you look at within those developers, we've kind of taken a bit more of a positive view on Ecuador, given the asset quality and lack of development that the country's seen over multiple decades. We've seen a real improving backdrop with the likes of Lundin Gold operating the future Del Norte project, and as a result, we like the geology. We think the country is turning more favourable, and we've got a couple of names like, say, SolGold and Solaris, which kind of fit into that rhetoric where, these are tier one scale projects of interest to Western majors, but also potentially open to Chinese majors who have been more active in making acquisitions globally. So we quite like those from firstly evaluation, firstly asset, second asset quality, and third M&A potential. So, those are two of the larger names that we have on the development side, for example.
So now let me ask you about critical metals, Robert, because before the recent run on gold, the mining sector was, perhaps it's fair to say, struggling to find a narrative, and most people reached for this catch-all term, critical metals, to kind of pitch their pitch their wares into the market. Now, what's your view on critical metals? Do you include copper in that category? And if so, why? And if not, why? And what else do you put into the basket?
Yeah, look, I mean, it depends how broad you want to paint it. But I mean, we've seen critical metals lists coming out from the likes of EU and US, and copper often falls within that. I would kind of put it more in, I'd look specifically to those commodities where China is very, very much in control of either production or processing. And we've seen a lot of support come behind things like rare earths, and we've had quite a long-term position in Lynas rare earths. And we've always liked that one, because it's the only Western producer that's materially producing actual end products. You know, a lot of the other rare earth projects that are out there are producing a rare earth concentrate that then has to be sent to China to be processed to get to the end product. And within that, you have a a number of different metals, and Lynas doesn't produce them all, because it's a very difficult process. And I think this is something that isn't always completely understood by many investors coming into rare earth names, is the actual process of separating them is very difficult, because they have quite similar chemical properties in many cases. So, you know, within, you know, typical processing for a commodity, for many metals, is you put it into an acidic solution, and then you'd precipitate it out once pH hit a certain level. But because these have similar properties, you end up having to vary it across three variables. So you end up having to have acidity, temperature, and pressure to pinpoint the point at which you precipitate out each specific commodity, which makes it, you know, hugely more complicated. Hugely more complicated to execute on. And that's one of the reasons why Western producers have struggled, and Lynas themselves struggled for a number of years. To be honest, the only reason they're still in existence is because the Japanese ended up kind of coming in and supporting them as they were trying to work through this difficult process of doing so. And the Japanese did it because the Chinese had put a rare earth ban on them through a trade war as well, which now the US is seeing. But we just don't believe it's that easy for other producers to replicate. So that's one of the reasons. That gives an example. But you know, for other critical metals, it's trying to find kind of nuanced commodities. So there's things like antimony or a number of others that end up coming through. Interestingly, quite a few of the Australian miners are now suddenly finding they have some of these critical metals in a meaningful proportion within their projects that they've previously kind of viewed as waste. But you know, with US-backed Department of War funding, Department of Energy funding to particularly projects in the US, but we're seeing it kind of feed through into some international projects as well. Then there is a real story behind this kind of critical metals aspect, which we kind of take a bit of caution on, but we quite like having them as a kind of free byproduct and optionality that we get. And we've done that through a couple of names.
So, would it be fair to say it's not a sort of central focus of the CQS proposition, but you are at sort of taking an active interest and you do have some exposure?
I mean, we definitely have some exposure. So, you know, we have. I mean, for example, so we have America's Gold and Silver, which owns the Galena mine, which is the largest producer of antimony within the US. We also have things like Talon Metals with a, you know, very high grade, nickel, copper. It's got some cobalt, and that will likely be a beneficiary of getting funding again within the US. That will likely be a beneficiary of getting some of this. We've got a name like Larvotto, which is a gold mine in gold and antimony mine in Australia. So we like it because the gold itself carries that, and we think it was attractive on that alone. And then the antimony aspect really just enhances the returns. Permitted, well, I mean, it was already permitted because it's going back into production, but it basically adds an extra layer over and above. But we don't use that as the base case for the investment, because actually we haven't had to.
And what about lithium? Because you know, that's sort of been up and down over the years. It was sort of really flying about 10 years ago, and then it's come back in more recent years. I think there's been some fairly positive trading days in the lithium stocks in Australia in the last couple of weeks, but it's not quite where it was. Do you have a view on that? Have you got any lithium?
Yeah, we do. We do have some. We're not as large as we have been previously. Look, you know, ultimately we are seeing a lot more electric cars being built. And when I say that, Maybe it's sort of stalled slightly in Europe, but if you look to BYD in China, they continue to increase the number of electric cars they're producing materially, and they're exporting them globally. So we are seeing more cars being built, and as a result, we should be needing more lithium. But this is where it gets a bit opaque because China ended up producing more, has managed to source more lithium than we could kind of visibly see. There were some mines in the likes of Zimbabwe that they brought online, as a result, brought on new supply, and we never kind of got that kind of huge recovery, even though we can kind of visibly see that demand is increasing. The supply side is a bit more opaque. So we like it, believe that lithium should recover, but it's just very difficult to call the timing on it because I would have said the same about 6 months, 6 months or so ago. Pricing is coming back. We're starting to see some performance in the equities, but I wouldn't say it's kind of one of our central core positions. So it's more of a kind of 2-3% position at current.
And what about some of the other metals? Let's just cover them off. I mean, things like zinc and lead, and off the top of my head, those are the two that come to mind. I'm sure there's some more that I haven't listed there. Do you have any sort of view about the base metals? Nickel, I suppose, is another one.
Yeah, so well, nickel's been tricky because of the huge growth of nickel laterites out of Indonesia, and for that reason, we've actually been very low on nickel for the last 8 9 years as a result. So we've had kind of little exposure to nickel. The one exception to that is being Talon Metals, which has nickel within its mine in the US, but it also has other commodities there. And actually, I think we're now at a point where nickel is arguably interesting if you get a project that kind of works around these prices, because we've seen this kind of new supply come in, and actually you end up kind of getting a bit more cost curve support around these kind of levels, rather than kind of going materially lower. So, with the likes of Talon, it has a very high grade, I mean, incredibly high grade. I saw them earlier in the week, and the core they're bringing is actually. They brought a piece with them, which was then heading to a museum after because of how exceptional it was. I mean, it was basically great. They're at 35 meters, grading at around 60% copper equivalent, for example, which you simply don't see. It's quite astounding. But yeah, zinc and lead, they've been tricky, to be honest. But it's we don't have a lot of exposure, and I guess part of that comes down to actually. The bottom up has been quite difficult as well. It's difficult to find names that kind of really stand out. Zinc also has quite a lot of feed from what China's been quite a major producer of. So we often avoid commodities China's a big producer of because you end up kind of seeing subsidies or costs can end up getting depressed. But it doesn't mean it's not potentially time to revisit, but it's one that we don't have a material exposure to currently. One I would add to it too, though, is tin. We think it's pretty interesting because it ties a lot more into the electrification trends, where it's used as solder within circuit boards and electrics. So we do have exposure to that through Metals X in Australia, with their asset in Tasmania.
Yeah, I think I mean tin was always touted as being a big growth metal by MIT, for a year for well probably that's probably a decade old, that research, but it seems to have been borne out pretty well, and I think some of London's investors quite like local tin stories too. I don't know if you've got any views on those.
I don't have a strong view, and the key reason has actually been that Metals X has been such attractive valuation for us that we've never really felt a need to kind of go earlier stage. They have taken some stakes in the likes of First Tin and some of these sort of smaller names that you talk to. So that's kind of been our preferred way of playing that, and as a result, we haven't kind of got too heavily into the weeds on the London-based names.
Right. So let's broaden it out again before we finish up, Robert. You mentioned in passing a few minutes ago the Department of Defense and the kind of influence that they bring to bear, and it seems to me that governments as a whole are playing a much larger role in influencing and being influenced by the trends in the mining sector than they were 5 or 10 years ago. And I was talking to Andrew Thake at Mines and Money, or Resourcing Tomorrow, I should say, the other day, And he was saying that they now have 55 governmental booths or groups that are presenting at Minds and Money, up from 36 governments that presented last year. And it seems like not only is that an interesting geopolitical trend, but it's supporting part of the resurgence in mining that we've seen over the last 6 months. And I wonder if you sort of have a view on that trend and whether you think it's going to continue for, into the future.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think resource protectionism is very real. I think the tensions that we've seen, a lot kind of being US-led, and we've seen a lot of the policies there. But, we've seen China very successfully use a rare earth export ban to basically get the US to U-turn on some of the trade restrictions it was putting through. And that's been a major Trump, well, Trump card's probably the wrong word. It's been a major card they've been able to play. To basically kind of protect themselves. And that's a very clear, obvious driver of where the US is looking to try and add rare earth capacity and supply to basically defend against that because of the impact it can have on across industries from their from their defense, planes, et cetera, or right through to chip manufacture, with AI being one of the front lines of the kind of global trade war. So yeah, look, I think we've seen a shift now. I think this kind of general trend, globalization trend, and being happy to rely on other nations and assuming that everything is going to be fine because they're reliant on you and you're reliant on them, and that kind of stops wars. I think the political view has shifted, and I think we're seeing it from the EU, US, and China, where they want to be a lot more self-dependent, and it's basically to stop other nations being able to enforce influence on them, and so they can be more independent. And that all comes back to the same driver of behind gold, why countries are adding gold, why we expect that to continue. And yes, I mean, at the margin, you will see some of these small commodities that are pretty irrelevant on an economic basis, certainly on a global level, having huge outsized impact. So, to chuck a few billion at it to try and solve that issue, ultimately addresses an issue that they view as a hundreds of billions, if not trillion-dollar kind of issue on bigger trade. So yeah, it's something we expect to continue. We expect, we're certainly seeing a lot more. We're seeing a lot of companies that are regularly through Washington, particularly across our uranium exposure, uranium mining exposure. So the US, 20% of their power comes from nuclear power. They've just committed to building 10 more reactors at a cost of 80 billion. Yet they only provide a fraction of their material from domestic sources. So, they're going to likely put in some measures there to try and support domestic production. They're probably going to lean into better relations with some offtake from some of the Canadian miners. So it's all these kind of moving parts. Geopolitics is definitely a big part of things, both funding and general trade flow. But what I would say is for earlier stage projects that are unpermitted, is it's materially shifted the dynamic there and political support for getting things permitted. So that's certainly something we're factoring into our numbers and assessments of how to view that risk, both on an absolute risk binary, do they or do they not get a permit, but also the timelines in doing so. So there's a lot more support, easy financing, subsidies, and general political support. So yeah, we think it's a pretty favorable time to be looking at that space.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the mining sector has sort of become unjammed, hasn't it, in the last 12 months or so. So, how does 2026 look to CQS then, Robert? Do you think your weightings are going to sort of stay the same through 2026? Do you have a kind of visibility about how the portfolio might evolve next year?
Yeah, I mean, so it's going to be market dependent and valuations. We've definitely got, I'd like to be adding a bit more energy oil here, but we're kind of struggling a little bit on valuations. The top down, I think we're kind of getting to a point where we have a clear oil glut now. There is an excess of supply in the market, some estimates of up to 2 million barrels a day. China's been buying as much as it can, some say to the tune of around 1 million barrels per day. In excess to their demand and stockpiling it. OPEC have just flooded the market, which sounds very bearish, but actually that is about should be as close to as bad as it gets, where Global demand is continuing to grow. OPEC will no longer have any spare capacity. Oil price is low, so it's now really dampening kind of US shale supply growth. So we're potentially in a dynamic where that begins to look a lot more interesting. But again, the bottom-up valuations need to be attractive enough to justify that. And you know, that's kind of a debate we've been having for a bit more of a pullback and correction in those names, and then would begin to potentially rotate and layer back in. But at the moment, it's you know, it's always a comp of you have to sell something to buy something. And it's very difficult to for us to justify selling some of these precious metal miners at current valuations and rotate into other sectors, especially if they look richer, even if we like the kind of underlying commodity trends, thinking that, you know, ultimately we kind of want to be a bit more contrarian and on that basis. But if it's not fully implicit within the underlying valuations, then it becomes quite tricky to make those shifts. So for the moment, we are very comfortable with our positioning, but we will dynamically look to kind of shift that. You know, again, if the precious metal miners got a lot more richer, you know, if the sector overall kind of went up 50% or so, then valuations begin to increase. But yeah, it's very fluid, and it's going to be market dependent. You know, last few days we've kind of started to have a bit of a wobble in broader markets. We had a number of red days. You know, there's some real question marks there around AI CapEx. Clearly, no one can really justify the numbers that are being spent in any kind of form of capital return on an asset that has a fairly short half-life in the sort of degradation or degradation shift. So, yeah, I think there's a real question mark starting to be asked. Markets are always difficult to call on the timing front, but yeah. Ultimately, we've kind of reduced down our gearing across all three trusts because we do see a period of potential volatility ahead and would like to keep a bit more flexibility for opportunities that present themselves.
When you talk about volatility, I'm wondering if you would characterize the current market in resources as a bull market. Do you think it is, or do you think that's a bit, a bit previous?
Yeah, like you always know it's a bull market when you look back and realize it was one. But no, I mean, I definitely think we are in a bit of a bull market. But at the same time, I think it's off an incredibly low base. So, you know, pretty negative sentiment. You know, this is a sector that's been completely villainized for the last decade as being kind of anti-ESG and anti-environment. And then suddenly the world's kind of woken up and realized, oh, actually, we can't do any of these kind of electrification trends or environmental things that we want to do without the key inputs to actually make them happen. And as a result, we've kind of seen this sort of dynamic shift towards what we kind of view as a kind of more realistic, economically driven view rather than a kind of idealistic, where actually the equation, you know, the full inputs is now become better understood rather than just a straight, you know. Yeah, I mean, nuclear would be the most prime example where people are shutting down nuclear reactors as on environmental terms, where actually it's the biggest form of zero carbon baseload power that offsets coal. You know, Germany shut down nuclear reactors to restart coal. So it's basically, I think there's a bit more of a rational justification to the world we're in and a better understanding of, you know, what is required to make these things happen. And we think commodities are well placed after, you know, a long period of limited investment.
So is it fair to say that the CQS outlook is optimistic then?
We're definitely optimistic. I think it's going to be a fast-moving world, and I think it's going to be important to be in the right places at the right time and avoid overexuberance. I think one thing we're seeing in markets now with a much greater shift towards, you know, passive funds and ETFs, etc., is you kind of get real wild swings away from kind of fair valuation, and that can be, you know, extended periods of being underappreciated and really overshooting on the other side as well, because it's not being driven by the same valuation metrics that we might have seen historically. So I think it's important to position, not get carried away in things, and you know, ultimately kind of take a bit more of a contrarian view where you can buy things with downside protection.
Robert Crayford, portfolio manager with CQS. Thanks very much for talking to us today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.